You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 376, Revelation 8, 7 through 13. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. I can't complain. Busy, doing lots of good stuff.
Well, Mike, you know, we get lots of emails from random people, and I think somebody reached out to you recently. That's pretty cool, if you want to tell that story.
Yeah, it was surprising. I got an email from a Major League Baseball pitcher. I'm not going to give the name here, but somebody who's read some of my stuff, watched some video, listens to the podcast, and this guy leads a Bible study in his clubhouse. So he had a question on the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, believe it or not. So it was just kind of cool, you know, that there's just stuff like that going on all the time that nobody knows about. You know, you never hear about it, never gets, you know, posted, you know, to thrown to the winds and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, there you go. You know, one of the Major League Baseball teams has a guy that's into the content and gets to lead a Bible study. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I like to hear athletes, Christian athletes, and actively studying in the clubhouse. That's pretty cool.
I should also go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's secretly what I wish I was doing in the clubhouse as a professional athlete studying the Bible. It sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, my only hope now is that he helps my fantasy team because I picked him up.
That was my first question to you. I was like, did you pick him up? And you're like, yep.
I did. So it's like, okay, you know, awesome. I'm giving you content here so you can get me some stats.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey,
my Naked Bible, you know, baseball team is in last place. It's really weird because I'm in first place in two of my brother's leagues and I'm in last place in this one. It's like, what in the world? So I don't know.
That's pretty sweet.
Who can figure it out?
Yeah. Well, hopefully they listen to this podcast since we talk sports, you know, maybe we'll get a listener too. So if you are in the clubhouse, shout out to y'all listening, you know, just in case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet. Well, hey, we're still in Revelation 8.
And people might have noticed, you know, by virtue of the title, that we are not going to get into chapter 9 today. We're going to finish chapter 8, so we're going to, you know, move into chapter 9 in its own episode. Because, you know, once I got into this, it's like, you know, there's just too much stuff here to talk about. So I'm not going to try to, you know, weed things out just to get through. So we will finish verses 7 through 13. Again, that's the rest of chapter 8. And these are the first four trumpet judgments. So that's what we'll cover today. And again, the focus here is to cover them in their Old Testament context. And so a lot of the discussion today is going to involve in some way the plagues on Egypt. You recall from the Exodus series that we did that the plagues were directed against Egyptian gods. And so consequently, there'll also be a couple of references to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview in this, which I suspect is going to be pretty unique in terms of how Revelation anywhere gets talked about. So we're going to go through the four trumpets, and again, just with an eye toward what is John, what are the visions, you know, that he sees, what are they hooking into as far as, you know, Old Testament imagery, and what might that mean, what might that suggest? So the first trumpet is Revelation 8:7. I'm just going to take these as we go through and just read the passage. Again, I'm reading ESV. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Now, there's an obvious correlation here with the plagues of Egypt. You've got the hail and the fire mixed with blood, so on and so forth. And Beal and McDonough comment this in the Old Testament, in the New Testament commentary that Beal and Carson edited. This verse is patterned after the Egyptian plague of hail and fire in Exodus 9, 23 through 25, specifically in the Septuagint, you have a strong correlation, overlap in the language, which reads, "And the Lord gave hail and fire upon the land, and the Lord rained upon all the land, and there was hail and flaming fire mingled with hail, and hail struck in all the land." You notice land is mentioned repeatedly there. "And the hail struck all the vegetation in the field, and the hail shattered all the trees in the field." So it's a little, you get a little bit of added detail there when you reference the Septuagint here. And Beal and McDonough go on to note, both Exodus 9 and Revelation 8:7 present an affliction of hail, together with fire sent from heaven against three parts of creation, the earth or the land, and the trees and the grass. And although the trial from Exodus has been limited in Revelation to two of its effects, to one-third, it has also undergone universalization. Now the affliction has effect throughout the whole inhabited earth, whereas obviously in Exodus it's on the land of Egypt. Now, the third wording here isn't really as transparent as to its context. Okay, going back to Revelation 8:7, a third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees burned up, all the green grass was burned up. So you have this third idea in there a couple of times. And where that might come from, again, isn't very clear. So Tonstad, in his commentary, says that there are so many threes, as you go through Revelation 8 and these trumpets, that it's kind of pointless to look to one Old Testament passage. And then he proceeds to say the most important third is going to be later in the book, Revelation 12, third of the stars. And then he proceeds to interpret this third and others by the third of the stars in Revelation 12 cast down. I don't know why he does that. He actually doesn't bother noting that passage's connection to Deuteronomy 8:10. So they're good guys. It's not like a judging evil or anything like that. And he doesn't argue for an identification specifically at all about the third of the stars, but then he proceeds to filter everything else through the dragon. Again, it honestly, his approach just doesn't make sense to me. It seems arbitrary, but I thought I'd mention it. He'll come up again later on when we go through different trumpets where I think he's tracking on things, something a little bit better. But a more common approach to the third language is reflected by On in his commentary, and he writes, "The eschatological destructions of one-third of various parts of the cosmos, which is a consistent theme throughout Revelation 8, really 8:2 through 9:21, is loosely based on Ezekiel 5, verse 2, where you get this language three times, Revelation 5:12 three times, where three different fates befall each third of the population of Jerusalem, represented by what Ezekiel does to each third of the hairs of his head and beard." So he... Oh, and again, this is common, thinks that the third language has something to do with Ezekiel 5. And that makes more sense than Tonstad, but honestly, not a whole lot. It amounts to using the third judgment language on Israel back in Ezekiel to describe the judgment of the world here. Now, Beal doesn't rule out a connection to Ezekiel 5, but other things he proposes, I think, are more simple. He says in one place, and this is his commentary, "In both Exodus 9 and Revelation 8:7, hail and fire are sent from God against three parts of creation, earth or land, you know, you can translate it either way, trees and grass. Revelation modifies the Exodus plague in that now only a third of the land and the trees are harmed, yet the affliction of all the grass remains unchanged." That would be similar to what goes on in Egypt. He continues, "Though the limitation to one-third may be carried over from the previous clauses, as is more clearly the case in Revelation 8:11b. Although in one sense the trial has been thus limited in its effects, it has also been universalized again in that now it has effect through the whole inhabited earth." And so then he goes on to offer another possibility, that, again drawn from the Old Testament, not Ezekiel 5. He writes, "Revelation 8:7 might also evoke Zechariah 13:8-9. And I'm going to just read that. So that listeners can get a feel for that. Revelation or Zechariah 13:8-9. "In the whole land, declares the Lord, two-thirds shall be cut off and perish, and one-third shall be left alive. And I will put this third into the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested." So if we actually go back in Zechariah 13, again, this is a judgment. Okay, it's a judgment on really what's going on, you know, in terms of Zechariah's timing. I mean, this is either, you know, exile or post-exilic, and it's really talking about Day of the Lord, and so you have a judgment, but then you also have a third that's spared. So if that's the case, Beal writes, this is at the end time, there's a fiery judgment that will affect thirds in Israel. Two parts will be cut off and perish, and a third will be left in it. "And I will bring the third through the fire." Beal says, "Both the righteous and godly suffer the same trial, but the trial positively refines the righteous, but only punishes the ungodly." So that, you know, might have a little bit more, you know, to do with things. It might fit, again, the context of Revelation 8 and 9 and going on through the book. about the righteous and the unrighteous, again, are affected by these plagues, these trials, but the righteous aren't going to be the ones that are destroyed, you know, that kind of thing. So they're refined through the process, or they will be brought through it in some way. So that feels to me like a bit of a better fit. There's another factor, though, and that's a structural one. That's going to become a little more relevant when we get to Revelation 9. I may mention it again, but this is just, I'm just going to throw this out because it's kind of interesting. Steve Moyes, again, in his book on Old Testament Revelation, observes how the trumpet judgments in Revelation 8 and 9, and even some material in chapter 10, follows the themes of Joel and Amos, like consecutively. What he means, he has a little chart in his book, and I'll try to relay this, but if you look at Revelation 8, 6 through 13, so that's what we're covering today in this episode, the first four trumpets. There's fire and sun and moon, you know, judged, and that's what happens in Joel 2. If you keep going into chapter 9 in Revelation, you get these locusts, scorpions, okay, smoke and locusts. Well, that happens in Joel 3. See, Joel 3 follows Joel 2. And so Revelation 8 and 9 seem to track on Joel 2 and 3. You keep going in Revelation 9, you get what Moyes calls this a lion cavalry, lions and fiery horses. And lo and behold, those are mentioned in Amos 1 and 2. And then on into Revelation 10, you have an angel of an oath and a mystery revealed to the prophets. And you'll actually read about that in Amos 3. So John is apparently in 8, 9, and 10 following Joel 2 and 3 and Amos 1 through 3, just in the ordering of things. And so that's probably going to be of some use in terms of the context of what's going on, especially when we hit Revelation 9. But taking that here, that might be a good Old Testament context for this language. And so we have maybe Ezekiel 5, maybe Zechariah 13, maybe Joel, you know, 2 has something to do with this. And one last note, particularly for those who might favor a recapitulation view of Revelation as opposed to a linear chronology reading of Revelation. Beale adds this note in his commentary. Revelation 8:7 also echoes Ezekiel 38:22. Remember, that's the Gog and Magog passage, which refers to the final end time defeat of Gog by the Lord. I will judge him with blood, sweeping rain, and hailstones, and I will rain fire on him. Doesn't that sound like Revelation? Sounds like Revelation 8, okay? Jewish exegetical tradition, Beale comments, used Ezekiel 38:22 in connection with the hail plague tradition of Exodus and applied it to end time events. So you say, well, why bother mentioning that? Well, as we're going to see as we keep going through the trumpet judgments, there's going to be similar language repeated, okay, in several of the trumpet judgments on into Revelation 9. And remember, there's this big debate about how we should read Revelation. Is it a linear chronology of events? That's typically the way like a dispensationalist would be taught, you know, or explain Revelation. It's a linear chronology. Other views would say, no, you have cycles of repetition. Okay, you have sets of things that just, you know, roll through those and then they repeat themselves. And so the book is not designed to be read as a linear chronology. There are repetitive factors. And that affects, for instance, when you get to Gog and Magog in Revelation 20, well, maybe some of that imagery actually already occurred. And so we don't have Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 8, you know, following a 1,000-year millennium. Maybe the millennium is really, again, the church on earth, and some of these judgments, Gog, Magog, again, all these trumpets and stuff like that, actually are things that are happening to believers and unbelievers simultaneously on earth, and they just keep getting recycled. They just keep getting described in slightly different language throughout the book, so that you can't establish a, quote, end times chronology from the book of Revelation. Like, it's just impossible to do that because it's not to be read as a linear chronology. So again, that's the kind of stuff, if we were talking about end times views, we would get into. But I thought it was worth observing here because you're gonna see this language repeated a lot. So let's go to Revelation 8:8 and 9. Really, let's just go through Revelation 8:8 through 11 and trumpets 2 and 3. We're gonna take them basically as, you know, together, because trumpet 3 is largely repetitive of trumpet 2, in terms of some of its language anyway. So I'm going to read this and you'll see what I mean. So Revelation 8:8, the second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Verse 10, this is the third trumpet. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on a third and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. Now, obviously, there's repetitive, very similar language in, you know, between both of those. This, you know, great mountain falling into the, you know, into the sea, and then sea becomes blood, and then creatures die, and then the next one is great star falls from heaven, falls on the fresh water, springs of water, and then, you know, people die, and the water's poisoned. So there's obviously some overlap here. You know, the plague references is really the sea turning to blood. That draws our attention right back to Exodus. That one's kind of obvious. The third trumpet, the water becoming bitter, kind of harkens back to the incident at Marah, where the waters were made bitter, Exodus 15. Yeah, this is following the Red Sea crossing. And between them, there's really little appreciable difference. And so Beale's commentary, he has some, you know, some things to say here about kind of the overlap and, you know, really that these two things can be read together. So with respect to trumpet two, okay, second trumpet, he writes, the likeness of a mountain could be metaphorical for a kingdom as it is elsewhere in the apocalypse, in the book of Revelation, and in the Old Testament more broadly, and in Jewish apocalyptic writings. And so he references Revelation 14:1, 17:9, 21:10, a few other things. Fire in the apocalypse and elsewhere is an image of judgment. Consequently, the burning mountain connotes the judgment of an evil kingdom. This meaning is supported by 18:21, where, quote, one strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, unquote. The angel immediately interprets the symbolism of his own action. Thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer, unquote. Revelation 18:20 also interprets this to mean God has pronounced judgment for you on your behalf, the saints, against her, against Babylon. So let me just stop there. What Beale's saying is this throwing this big stone or, you know, this quote-unquote mountain into the sea. He says there are passages where there are similar language to that, both within the book and outside the book, where this mountain thing is actually a kingdom. And, you know, he draws attention to Revelation 18, where it's Babylon. I mean, you could also go back to Daniel and you have the stone made without hands. You know, that's actually the kingdom of God. I mean, again, there are other references like this that take let's just say it this way, cosmic mountain imagery and relate it to either God's kingdom or the kingdom under some other deity. All right. So he just wants to make his readers aware that sometimes this language gets used of actual kingdoms. So back to Beale, he says, Jeremiah 51:25 refers to Babylon's judgment this way. This one's very clear. I am against you, O destroying mountain. Okay. I mean, Babylon's called a mountain there. And I will make you a burned out mountain. Again, the language is pretty explicit there. Let's see. He says, note likewise 1 Enoch 18:13 and 21:3, in which the preliminary judgment of the fallen angels is spoken of as, quote, stars like great burning mountains. Again, that language is used of fallen supernatural beings. Okay, that this judgment is alluded to in Revelation 8:8, Beale writes, is apparent from the repeated allusion to it in the seventh trumpet. See note on 11:18b. Okay, we'll get to the seventh trumpet later because it's in a later chapter, and also from Jeremiah 51:27, blow a trumpet among the nations, quote unquote, which is a signal to gather armies against Jerusalem. Later in the same oracle of judgment, Jeremiah speaks of a scroll of woe written against Babylon tied to a stone. Here we go again with this, you know, big stone imagery of Babylon, and thrown into a river. Jeremiah interprets this symbolic action by saying, so shall Babylon sink down and not rise again. And so Beale says, here we have the basis of Revelation 18:21, which we just read. So he says, therefore, the picture of Revelation 8:8 did not originate from an attempt to depict a literal volcanic eruption or some other natural phenomenon occurring in the first century or predicted for later. A literal reading is rendered unlikely here and throughout the visionary section by the simple observation that the catastrophes are inspired primarily by Old Testament literary models that contain figures of speech. This does not mean that such models could not have been used to describe literal disasters, but the burden of proof is on those who hold to a literal understanding in addition to a figurative perspective. The destruction of ships here anticipates the description again in Revelation 18, so it's going to be repeated later on. just like the mountain stuff. We're going to see the ships destroyed, okay, in Revelation 18. There it's the complete destruction of the, quote, great city Babylon, again, pointing back to Babylon, which was the source of maritime commerce. Every shipmaster and all who sail anywhere and every sailor and as many as work on the sea cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, and they were weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe is the great city through which all those who have ships in the sea become wealthy because of her wealth. It's Revelation 18, 17 through 19. The seafarers mourn because they realize Babylon's destruction entails their own demise. There may be in 8:9 an implicit idea of the shortage of water, since that was a major effect of the Nile turning into blood back in Exodus 7, which would intensify the picture of maritime disaster here. But the aspect of the Exodus background is expressed explicitly only with the third trumpet. The judgment of the great city, the great mountain, Babylon the Great, results in famine, which affects part of the entire world, here the sea, and the sea is figurative for unbelieving peoples later in Revelation 17, 1 and 15. But that may not be the cause here, or the case here, because 8:9 continues with a description of what was in the sea. On the other hand, in the light of the influence of Jeremiah 51, it is probably no coincidence, that Jeremiah 28 in LXX describes Babylon's demise with the metaphorical picture of a sea that has come up upon Babylon and she is covered. Now, again, Beale goes on for quite a bit, demonstrating, again, that the language, here's his point, the language in Revelation 8, you're going to find repeated in Revelation 18 and some in 17. And if you trace that back to the Old Testament, in all these places, it leads to one destination, that is Babylon. This is about the destruction of the world system, i.e. Babylon, that is hostile to God and his people. That's what the trumpets are about. And he's saying, look, if you're going to take the Old Testament imagery seriously, you're not going to be postulating, you know, an asteroid impact, you know, or something like that, that, you know, for Wormwood, that you know, this is what's commonly out there in the internet, that either this is refers to a volcanic eruption in the first century, or we're going to get hit with an asteroid later, you know, or something like that. He's saying, look, you know, we have all this Old Testament imagery here used in this chapter and then repeated, where this language is repeated in chapter 18. Again, we have references that clearly go back to Babylon in the imagery. And that makes sense if we're reading the book of Revelation, because these are the trumpet judgments. They're judgments against the people who have been persecuting God's people. I mean, how much more obvious could it be? And Babylon itself is going to be mentioned in the book of Revelation as the entity or city or, you know, supernatural force, you know, the cosmic Babylon behind this persecution. And so those people, the people of the nations and their gods, are the ones who are subject to these judgments. And that goes all the way back to the Old Testament, where Babylon is the poster child for anti-Eden in the Old Testament, cosmic evil. And not only that, but where do we get the nations and their gods to begin with? Aha, Genesis 11, Deuteronomy 32, Babylon. Again, it actually coheres really well if we pay attention to the Old Testament imagery. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be able to sort of figure out, like, okay, what exactly, precisely, you know, is being described here. You know, it's not going to answer the question of, you know, should we be preterists now or should we not? Because again, those questions are tied to bigger questions about the date of the book and you know, things like this. And Beale, you know, Beale was what he would call an idealistic amillennialist. He's not going to be, you know, like in the preterist camp. He doesn't live there. But, you know, again, you get the idea. If you ignore the Old Testament connections and read Revelation simply as a linear chronology, you're not going to get any of this. It's all going to just be invisible to you. Let's go to trumpet 3. Again, we're taking 2 and 3 in tandem, and Beale has a few things to say about third trumpet specifically. Here Beale actually gets into what we would recognize as Deuteronomy 32 worldview language. And you might ask, well, how? And the answer to that is the language for fallen divine beings, i.e. fallen stars, gets married to judgment of the earth's nations. Just, you know, this is Psalm 82, Deuteronomy 32. So Beale writes, with the third trumpet, the judgment of famine appears to be continued. The misery of foul, undrinkable water implicit in the second trumpet is brought to the fore. Therefore, Exodus 7 still stands in the background. Again, the plagues as is also evident from the statement here that, quote, rivers and springs of waters, unquote, were affected. And that's the wording drawn from Exodus 7:19. The similarity is enhanced by Psalm 88:44, which paraphrases the Exodus plague by saying that God, quote, changed their rivers, plural, into blood, and their streams, that they should not drink. So Psalm 78:44, let me just break in here, which describes the Exodus plagues, is actually a really, really close parallel to both Trumpets 2 and 3. It covers what happens there. Back to Beale. He says, as with the second trumpet, so again here a great fireball is thrown from heaven. This time it is not depicted as a great mountain, but as a, quote, great star burning like a torch, unquote. If this is a continuation of the similar judgment of the first two trumpets, then the fire can again be understood as a metaphor of famine. We have observed elsewhere that stars represent angelic beings in Revelation, the Old Testament, and post-biblical Judaism. These angels themselves often corporately represent earthly peoples. Again, that would make sense. And kingdoms, that would make sense. Again, Deuteronomy 32 worldview. And fire symbolizes judgment in the apocalypse and other related literature. The same must be the case here. As in verse 8, we see here the judgment of an angel who is a legal-like representation of sinful people. Again, these are the gods of the nations. You know, this is Deuteronomy 32 worldview thinking. Now, what's interesting here is Beale actually finds this in rabbinic literature. He says the Midrash Rabbah for Exodus 9:9 interprets Exodus 7:16 through 18, that plague on the waters, which is still in the background of Revelation 8:10, as a judgment on heavenly beings. Like, rabbinic Judaism actually saw this. It interprets this plague, the plague on the waters, as a judgment on heavenly beings, just like Revelation's doing. In other words, in that case, it's the Nile deity, who are legal agents, this is Beale's language, who are legal agents representing sinful people, the latter of whom are likewise affected. Isaiah 24:21. This is a passage should be familiar to those of you familiar with, again, what I write, Deuteronomy 32 worldview, Day of the Lord judgment, combined with Deuteronomy 32, you know, thinking. Isaiah 24:21 is adduced in support of Midrashic interpretation, quote, the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings of the earth on the earth. So there you get both. There you get both. Again, Mike isn't making this up. There it is right in the rabbis, where you have Isaiah 24 describing a judgment of not only earthly armies, but those supernatural beings which correspond to the punished nations right there in the same passage. Okay. So he references another rabbinic text, commenting on Exodus 12:2 for the same thing. He says, so similarly, Midrash Rabbah, Exodus 23:15, affirms that both the Egyptians and their guardian angel, again, this is rabbinic language, patron angels associated with the nations. Let me just stop here. What's really striking about this is that a lot of this rabbinic stuff, now catch this, this is going to be really important to some of you out in the audience, because I always get this, you know, well, the traditional Hebrew text, doesn't say that the nations were allotted to the sons of God. That's the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint. We're going to stick with the traditional Hebrew text, regardless of whether it makes sense or not. We're just going to stick with it because it's the Masoretic text. What do you think the rabbis in the early medieval period are using? They're using the traditional Masoretic text, but they still have this theology. Lo and behold, they're still catching it. Now, that either suggests, and I've made this comment before, you know, the idea that there is one Masoretic text that every Jew after 100 AD followed slavishly and just, you know, bought what the Council of Rabbis who decided to standardize the text, bought what they were selling. That is not true. Within the Jewish community, there is still a multiplicity of texts, and I'm willing to bet, because the theology comes through real nicely here, in the Jewish community, I'm willing to bet that the Deuteronomy 32:8 reading of Qumran did survive, in the minds at least, of some people, if not the texts. You know, it's still there. The theology is still there one way or the other. Now, I've referenced Aptewitzer before. It was a German scholar who collected all of the citations of the Hebrew Bible in rabbinic writings. It's seven volumes. It's in German, unfortunately. And if you look at his work, it makes the point that the rabbinic community, the Jewish community, the serious community, the rabbis, okay, that we all like to talk about, the rabbis, they were quoting Hebrew Bible texts that in places do not align with the Masoretic text. They had their own preferences. There are variations. So I'm just saying, you know, it's no defense. You know, you can try to retreat from the theology all you want. But, you know, we can whip out here some rabbinic texts that have the same Deuteronomy 32 worldview in them and say, well, what about that? Check that out. So let's go back to Beal. Again, he's commenting on Midrash Rabbah, Exodus 23, affirms that both the Egyptians and their guardian angel were judged at the Red Sea. Egyptians and their guardian angel. Gosh, where are they getting that? This interpretation is supported by 1 Enoch 18:13. You know, how dare he invoke Enoch when commenting on rabbinic texts? But he does. 1 Enoch 18:13, 1 Enoch 21:3, which describe the judgment of fallen angels as, quote, stars like great burning mountains, and 1 Enoch 108:3 to 6, which borrows the same image to portray the punishment of sinful people. Again, this association of punishing fallen angels, you know, quote unquote, with people, like marrying those two things together. Folks, that is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. That's what it is. It's the Psalm 82 worldview. Back to Beal. Revelation 8:10 appears then to portray judgment that people and their representative angels endure throughout history, and that precedes their final condemnation at the end of history. The burning star could, on the other hand, represent merely an agent of divine judgment. However, the observation that the descent of the burning mountain in verse 10 is parallel to the descent of the burning star in verse 8 also indicates that the star should be identified as an angelic representative of an evil kingdom undergoing judgment. Here, the judgment of Babylon's angel is in view, since verse 8 concerns the judgment of Babylon the Great. Okay. Let's transition a little bit to wormwood. I want to say a few things about this. What about the terminology wormwood? ESV Study Bible has a note. Wormwood, the Greek is opsinthos, is the name of a plant and of the bitter-tasting extract derived from it. Artemisia absinthium. Now, the curious thing is there's no direct Septuagint use of this Greek term. Might sound surprising, but it's true. And so Beal, Silva. Moises Silva is the editor. I don't know who wrote the article off the top of my head, but this is from the New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology and Exegesis. It's a multi-volume word study resource. And we read there, the form absinthos is not attested prior to the New Testament, although it occurs twice in Aretaeus, a medical author from Cappadocia, who lived in the 2nd century AD, and then mainly in Christian writers thereafter. In the classical period, this word occurs in the form absinthon, Hippocrates, for example, and other medical writers. It refers to Artemisia absinthium, a herbaceous perennial with silky leaves that bears masses of small yellow flowers, and it yields a bitter dark oil that is sometimes used medicinally to kill intestinal worms. Isn't that pleasant? In Jewish literature, neither form occurs in the Septuagint, but Aquila uses it to translate a particular word, le'ana, in Proverbs 5:4. Let me just reference Proverbs 5:4 so that we can sort of think back to it here. Proverbs 5:4, in the end, she is bitter as wormwood. And so we have the word translated in English here, wormwood, is le'ana, which in Aquila, again, this is an early writer that has a relationship to the Septuagint, but he's not the point of origin for what we think of as the Septuagint. He does use absinthos. Okay, so there's some correlation. We're gonna see Proverbs 5:4 again in a moment. The problem is, back to Silva, that here the affected water causes death, whereas wormwood, at least as we understand the term, is bitter, but not poisonous. The author may have in mind a different substance that was genuinely poisonous, or he may be employing a way of speech not uncommon in antiquity, whereby bitterness and poison were connected. He may be reasoning from the bitterness of the taste to the bitterness of the results. This fits in also with the fact that in the Old Testament, wormwood or gall is used of God's punishment of the wicked. I will make this people eat bitter food, la'ana. Again, that's the same word found in Proverbs 5:4. and drink poison water. So Jeremiah 9:15, I think it's 14 in the Septuagint. I will make this people eat bitter food, la'ana food. Okay. So that's wormwood or gall. Again, which is kind of interesting because, you know, of the reference to Jesus and the cross and what they offer him and what he refuses and so on and so forth. But anyway, Beal goes on. Let's bring Beal into the picture here. That was Silva. He writes this: the metaphor was chosen to show that judgment was well suited to the crime because the prophets figuratively polluted Israel with idolatry. So God is pictured as polluting them with bad water. In other words, the prophets bring judgment against Israel because of their idolatry. They bring out its pollution. And so God, again, is sort of, you know, returning the gesture, the favor. In other words, it's referring to the bitterness of suffering, and the suffering is well deserved. This figurative meaning is confirmed from the indisputable metaphorical uses of the word everywhere else in the Old Testament, where it also represents severe affliction resulting from divine wrath, Deuteronomy 29:17-18, again connected with idolatry. So la'ana there is connected with idolatry. Proverbs 5:4 we've already mentioned. He has a number of other citations, Amos 5:7, 6:12, Hosea 10:4. Again, there are places in the Old Testament where la'ana, that word depicting bitterness, connects it to suffering, and it also connects it to idolatry. And so what Beal is saying, this concatenation of associations is how we need to go back and look at what's being written here in Revelation. So Beal comments again. He says, likewise, in Revelation 8:11, Babylon, the prevailing world system, has influenced the earth dwellers and some in the covenant community to become idolatrous. And the consequences of such idolatrous pollution is judgment on both Babylon and those held under its sway. Against this Old Testament background, the third trumpet does not unleash a woe in which water becomes literally poison. Rather, the tone is one of judgment that brings bitter suffering, including death. And not only on the outsiders to the covenant, but also on the purported members of the community of faith that turned to idolatry. They're all going to suffer bitterly, is Beal's point. Again, using it metaphorically. Beal adds one more thought. The judgment of poisoning water with wormwood in 8:11 conveys the idea of famine and so continues the theme of the preceding two trumpet woes. This is in line with the ideas seen in early Jewish writings. So this connection with famine, look, if your plants are burned up, and if the water that waters those plants, you know, is made bitter or poisonous to those plants, guess what? You're not going to have a lot to eat. That's the connection with famine, which again, you know, goes back to, you know, the Old Testament and the whole Egyptian, you know, situation as well. Let's go to trumpet 4. Trumpet 4 in the transition to chapter 9. I'll read the last two verses of the chapter. The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow. So that one's looking forward into what is yet to come. So in verse 12, the fourth trumpet is at least in part an allusion based on Exodus 10:21-22, the plague of darkness over Egypt. Again, Egypt was the persecutor of God's people, and it lasted 3 days. Recall from Exodus and our series there that the plagues were directed again against Egyptian gods, and none more noteworthy than this one, the blotting out of the sun. Okay, just think how solar theology was so important to Egypt, and this one would have really freaked them out. Early Jewish literature, for example, the Wisdom of Solomon, and this is in the Apocrypha, if you have an English translation of the Septuagint, you can find it there too. So the Wisdom of Solomon in particular, that material interpreted the plague of darkness to have symbolic significance. Exile from the true God, prisoners of darkness. Amos 8:9 is also likely part of John's reference, in that case, a judgment on apostate Israelites patterned after the plague on Egypt. The fourth trumpet language may harken back to the creation account, though, as well. Now, this is a little bit of a different thought. It's obvious to see, you know, a connection back to the Egyptian plague, the plague of darkness. But On and a few other commentators wonder about it. There might be another antecedent in the Old Testament, and they go back to the creation account. Here's what he means. He writes, "It is perhaps not mere coincidence that on the fourth creative day, God is reported to have created the sun, moon, and stars. This is Genesis 1, 14 to 19. So that the cosmic destruction that occurs here, Owen writes, can be understood against the background of the creation account. So what he's getting at there is a situation that reverts to pre-day four chaos. Okay. Elsewhere, Owen notes the ancient Jewish context of the mid-heaven terminology. Okay, in you know, some of these passages. So if we go back to I'll just continue with on this. It's Revelation 8:13 for the sake of this passage. It's going to come up again a little bit later, but let me go to Revelation 8:13 again. Then I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Okay, the overhead terminology there is actually mes uranema. So uranos in Greek is heaven, mes is midst. So it's actually a term that means mid-heaven, directly overhead. If you think about the imagery, you look directly over your head, the sun would be like right in the middle of the sky. So it's mid-heaven. You say, well, who cares? Well, you know, Owen is going to comment on this terminology and he sees something interesting here. He says the noun ta mes uranema, mid-heaven, occurs three times in Revelation, 8:13, 14:6, 19:17. The term also occurs on a magical amulet, probably of Jewish origin, with a sun, moon, and two stars on the obverse, and this inscription on the reverse. One God in the heavens, who exists and who pre-exists, who is greater than all, who dominates all the beings in mid-heaven, unquote. It's kind of interesting. This position of dominance also makes the reference to the eagle interesting. So What he's basically saying is the mid-heaven term was the place, it's the center of the heavens, and at the center of the heavens is the place from which God rules everything in heaven. That's the idea. So now he's going to move from that, and then he's going to talk about the eagle. So Owen writes, the eagle was regarded as the messenger of Zeus. This is me now talking, as in earlier references in Revelation 1, be a usurpation of Zeus's most high status. Let me just stop there. Go back to the amulet, the mid-heaven, you know, amulet, the most likely Jewish amulet that is talking about Yahweh, one God in the heavens. Look at who exists, who is, and who was, and is greater than all. Who exists, who pre-exists, and is greater than all. So that God, again, is mid-heaven. He's the one who actually controls things. And then the eagle reference, again, regarded as a symbol of the messenger of Zeus. No, it's not the symbol of the messenger of Zeus for John. It's the symbol of the messenger of the God of Israel. Because the God of Israel is the one sending the angel, okay? So this is actually a kind of an oblique way, again, it's taken a shot at Zeus's claim to be most high. It's kind of interesting. You know, I thought I'd loop that in here. It's a bit obscure, you know, in terms of maybe first century Jewish cosmology. It's not technically Old Testament. But again, it's another swipe at Zeus, which we saw back in Revelation 1:4. You know, John do this a couple times. Now, Pilch and Malina. Malina is a name familiar to the podcast audience. He's the one who did the book on astral theology in Revelation. The book is called On the Genre and Message of Revelation. He has a co-author, Pilch. They're both New Testament scholars. And they wrote a separate book, a social science commentary on the book of Revelation. And they note this about the astral theological worldview context of the mid-heaven and the eagle and all that. They write, as we have previously noted, the word translated here as mid-heaven, mes uranema, is a technical term in astrology and astronomy. The eagle in this context occupies the position of the constellation Pegasus. Its location in mid-heaven points to its significance. This is because, and they're going to quote Firmicus Maternus, who is a, you know, an ancient astronomer. This is because frequently, or rather always, in all charts, the medium, the mid-heaven, holds the principal place. Again, this is sort of like the center of the universe idea. Earlier in discussing Revelation 4 and the heavenly creatures full of eyes, in the same commentary, Pilch and Malina wrote this. Stars are called eyes. Because of this, the four living creatures full of eyes would be constellations. You know, we covered this back in Revelation, you know, 4. But to continue, he says, full of stars, both here as well as in Ezekiel 1 and 10, you know, give us in this scenario what seems that in this scenario, they would bear the throne on their cosmic backs while the front of their eyes faces outward. So if you think, let me just stop here. If you think of the four cherubim, if you think of their constellations, they're going to be facing outward. And then, you know, the back parts of them are going to be facing inward. And then atop them is where the deity sits and so on and so forth. So just get that image in your mind, these four constellations and so on and so forth. So they write, the four constellations, both here as well as in Ezekiel, are the four Babylonian seasonal constellations, Scorpio, Leo, Taurus, and Pegasus. Pegasus, a constellation which a Babylonian inscription calls the, quote, leader of the stars from the divinity Anu, unquote, namely refers to the stars of the equator. This constellation was the Babylonian thunderbird, the flying eagle, to be identified with the constellation called Hippos in the Greek sky. This constellation occurs again in Revelation 8:13. So this is the eagle they're saying is the Pegasus, the flying, you know, the flying eagle here in astral theological thinking. In Babylonian lore, this is traceable to the 7th century BC. Pegasus is the leader of the stars along the celestial equator, just as Aries is the leader of the stars in the ecliptic. Thus, each of these constellations bears a royal star, that is, enough to prove their special significance in Greek astronomy and astrology, which follows Babylonian sources in this case. These four constellations are likewise depicted in a Babylonian source as designating the four directions of the sky, for they lie about 90 degrees from each other. In this position, they duly circumscribe the whole vault of the sky, and in our scenario, the references to the throne of God would refer to the whole of the sky. Furthermore, since these constellations stood at the equator opposite each other, the phrase, quote, in the middle of the throne and around the throne, unquote, makes sense, for the equator both cuts the sky in half and goes around it. Now, what's the point of bringing their commentary from Revelation 4 into Revelation 8 with the mid-heaven thing and Pegasus and whatnot? If you're thinking on these terms and then you read Revelation, you realize that what John is doing. John is saying that no, you know, the Greek pantheon, Zeus or whoever, again, the eagle being a symbol of Zeus, this mid-heaven, you know, Pegasus that's supposed to be like this marking that where Zeus's throne is. John is basically taking all of that and not throwing it in the dumpster, but he's saying, no, we're going to kick Zeus off the throne here. We're going to take Zeus out of this position. You know, the constellations that map out time and all this sort of stuff, they were created by God, okay, the God of Israel back in Genesis. He is the one, just like in Ezekiel 1, who sits on the throne and controls the course of time and history. Again, this is like Ezekiel 1 messaging tucked away in one verse in Revelation 8. That's the whole point. Again, if you have this kind of thinking in your mind as a first century pagan or even possibly a first century Jew, if you were interested in this sort of thing, you know, astronomy, you would know all these things and you would have been exposed to the religious significance of the terminology in a first century Greco-Roman astro-theological worldview. And John is basically just wiping Zeus right out of the picture. That's the point. So, in terms of John's theology, the judgment of Babylon and its gods is what's happening with the first four trumpets. You know, Zeus isn't on the throne. His Babylonian equivalent isn't on the throne. The God of Israel is on the throne, the God of heaven, and also the God who is Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, who is going to punish those who are persecuting the people who are loyal to him. And again, that he's using all this messaging, taking our minds back to the Old Testament, specifically the judgment of Babylon, because Babylon was the primo persecutor of the people of God in the Old Testament. They're the ones who took Judah, the royal dynasty, into exile. They're the ones that destroyed the temple. Okay, they are ground zero for anti-Eden chaos thinking. All that is opposed to what God wants. Okay, they just wiped out. And yeah, they did it under the sovereignty of God and punishment for Israel's apostasy. We get that. But they still bear this label. And so here in Revelation, John is dipping into, in terms of both symbology and also quotations about Babylon from the Old Testament that fit right into, again, the Old Testament judgment now being transferred into the enemies of God in the book of Revelation, who are getting what they deserve. just to reinforce the notion of who's in control, that would be God, and who, you know, is going to be punished. Well, that's the people on the boots on the ground, people who persecute the people of God and their gods are going to be punished. And why you say, well, what about Egypt? Why would Egypt get looped into this? Before Babylon, which nation was the nation that was the major force of chaos that persecuted the people of God? That would be Egypt. Okay? It's a repetitive theme. The supervillain changes. Okay? Egypt, and then it becomes Babylon. These are the two focal points. And if you think about the birth of Israel, you know, in terms of being brought out of Egypt, passing through the sea, entering into a covenant, you know, a renewed relationship with God at Sinai. Well, that's where things, you know, sort of begin again, you know, post Abraham. I mean, Abraham's, you know, obviously the person God chooses to, you know, raise up Israel as a seed, as a new humanity. And again, even Abraham has Mesopotamian origins, possibly Babylonian, you know, depending on where Ur is. But you see the Babylon thing or the Mesopotamia thing. Then it's Egypt. Now it's back to Babylon. All these episodes sort of telegraph the conflict between what God wants, the Edenic relationship, you know, to be God among His people on Earth. Okay, and what happens? You know, what happens to the whole plan? It gets destroyed. Why? Not because God wants it destroyed, but because of disloyalty. Okay. Unbelieving disloyalty, the opposite of believing loyalty. That's why it happens. Apostasy, moving over to some other God. And it just gets repeated here in Revelation using the same Old Testament themes. So again, if we're not, you know, if we're reading the book of Revelation and we're using a newspaper as our commentary, and we're reading it in linear fashion only. Again, my view is that both things happen. There's both recapitulation and there's both linear. But if you're reading the book of Revelation with Meet the Press as your commentary or the newspaper or something like that, and you're blind to how the Old Testament is used by John, all of this is invisible. All of this is invisible. You're going to be talking black helicopters and asteroid hits. And that is just not the point. It's just not the point. So again, what we're trying to do in this series, and what we'll continue on with in Revelation 9, we pick up the other, at least 5 and 6, the trumpet judgments there, is to at least encourage you to look up some of these references. The cross references in your Bible are there for a reason. Okay, because scholars who produce these things in committee translation projects, these cross references are supposed to help you, you know, locate the context or at least a parallel to what's being said in your translation. And when those cross-references lead you back to the Old Testament, chances are high that that has some importance for how we should interpret what we're reading in the New Testament, in this case, the book of Revelation. But anyway, next time we'll pick up with Revelation 9. Everybody likes Revelation 9 because of the locusts and all that stuff. And if you've read Reversing Hermon, you already know I think this has something to do with the release of the Watchers and whatnot. But that'll be in the next episode as we pick up with the next two trumpet judgments and tackle that chapter.
All right, Mike, looking forward to that. Lots of questions in 8 and 9. I suspect we'll be getting a lot. And again, I want to remind our listeners that I've been getting some emails about Revelation, and I want to remind them that I'm collecting them, and we're going to do a Q&A, several Q&As probably, just on Revelation. I've got a few questions about that, Mike. So I'm collecting them, we're saving them. And then at the end, the conclusion of Revelation on the podcast, we'll have several Q&As.
I've also gotten a couple emails, you know, and again, I'm glad you mentioned that, Trey, because we are going to wait till we're done with the book to do the Q&A about Revelation. And like Trey said, there'll be more than one, we're sure. So make sure Trey is the one who gets your questions and email, because he's compiling those.
I think we had 3 Q&As covering the last book.
Something like that.
Yeah. So I'm sure this one is going to be a lot. They're already starting to pour in. So TreyStrickland@gmail.com. That's where you can send that. And if you don't know how to spell my last name, then go to NakedBiblePodcast.com and get the correct spelling. Because I think lots of people, I get some emails about that. Oh, I've been misspelling your name.
Yeah, they're bouncing. So
long. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Mike, that's awesome. We'll be looking for chapter 9 next week. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.